Presented in partnership with the U.S. Army Office of Public Affairs, Midwest. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents, with a discussion about the history of ROTC and JROTC with guests Colonel Andy Morgado, Dr. Arthur Coombe, and Colonel Daniel Baggio. I'm your host, Ken Clark, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago, and it's presented in partnership with the U.S. Army Public Affairs Midwest. This program, and hundreds more, are available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. The Army Reserve Officers Training Corps, or ROTC, and the Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, or JROTC, began 100 years ago, with President Wilson signing the National Defense Act of 1916, a year before the United States entered into World War I. Although military training had been taking place in civilian colleges and universities as early as 1819, the signing of the National Defense Act brought this training under a single, federally controlled entity, the Reserve Officers Training Corps. Army ROTC is the largest officer-producing organization in the American military, having commissioned more than 500,000 second lieutenants since its inception. ROTC is offered at approximately 1,000 colleges and universities and provides cadets with scholarships in addition to their officer training. Junior ROTC begins in high school and teaches students character education, student achievement, wellness, leadership, and diversity. Colonel Andy Morgado is Brigade Commander, 3rd Brigade, U.S. Army Cadet Command, commander of Senior and Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps units across a 10-state region in the Upper Midwest. He was commissioned a second lieutenant of armor in 1994 from the ROTC program at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. He graduated with a Bachelor's of Arts degree in government and earned his master's in diplomacy from Norwich University. In 20 years on active duty, he served on 3 deployments to Iraq, 2 operational deployments to Korea, and served in a variety of command and staff positions in the continental United States. Dr. Arthur Coombe is a colonel of the United States Army and an associate professor of history and researcher historian in the Office of Economic and Manpower Analysis. Dr. Coombe earned a Bachelor's of Science in National Security and Public Affairs from the U.S. Military Academy in 1973 and a Ph.D. in History from Duke University in 1985. Previously, Dr. Coombe was a historian for the U.S. Army Cadet Command, the organization responsible for the management of the Army's ROTC program. A military historian by training, Dr. Coombe's primary research interests are officer education and management, officer accessions, and the religious history of the U.S. Military Academy. Coombe is the author of several books about the history of Cadet Command. Colonel Daniel Baggio is the Director of Military Instruction for Chicago Public Schools. He is Chief Administrator and Instructional Leader, responsible for resourcing and leading 45 JROTC programs in high schools across Chicago, with a cumulative enrollment of approximately 10,000 cadets. He earned a Bachelor's of Science in Physical Education from the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater and a Master's of Art in Human Speech Communication from the University of Northern Colorado, as well as a Master's of Strategic Studies from the United States Army War College. Colonel Baggio's 30 years on active duty include 11 years overseas in command and staff positions in Korea, Japan, Belgium, and Turkey, and serving as the U.S. Army Forces Command Chief of Public Affairs. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library Colonel Andy Morgado, Dr. Arthur Coombe, and Colonel Daniel Baggio. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Let's get into the nuts and bolts of what ROTC is and what it does and what JROTC is. And I would like each of you to spend a moment telling me, from your perspectives, what the programs are and what they do and what they mean to you.
Great. Thanks, Ken. I really appreciate that. I have the distinct privilege of being 3rd Brigade Army ROTC Commander for the Upper Midwest and responsible for both senior and junior ROTC. Though both programs fall underneath the umbrella of my command, I would say they're two very distinct programs. Senior ROTC is essentially charged or given a mission to produce quality leaders for our Army. It's a matter of national security to provide our soldiers, our Army, quality leadership. So that's our primary mission on the senior side. So we're looking for leaders of character. We develop them as scholar, athletes, and leaders, and we want them to be professional Army soldiers and join a profession when they're complete with their college education. I'll let the subject matter expert on junior kind of feel that portion of it.
Okay. Yeah, the junior ROTC program, we are a citizenship program. We're a leadership program. We focus on, our core curriculum is actually aligned with the Common Core, in fact, since 2012. So we focus on critical thinking, problem solving, collaboration. In fact, one of our academic competitions we have right here at the Pritzker Museum and Military Library is our GROTC Leadership and Academic Bowl. So we focus on those sorts of things. Another key element that we do is we do a lot of service learning. Some of our projects include doing fundraising for cancer research, feeding the homeless, taking care of veterans. All the 45 programs have to do service learning projects. So it's about learning to give back to your community, whether it be your high school involvement, and it puts the kids in a great leadership position with a military model. But by no means does anybody that go in JROTC, we're not recruiters. That is not our mission.
Arthur?
I think they've outlined the purpose and the differences between the two programs fairly well. I would only add that both programs since 1916 have been focused on reaching out to the American public, helping the public understand the defense mission, helping the public understand what is unique about the military and some of the problems and needs the military has. And both programs, I think, have been tasked to do that really for the last century.
I'm sorry, Dr. Kovac, that's a great point and super question, because one of the biggest hurdles or obstacles that we face in ROTC is exactly that, is drawing the distinction about what our programs do and what we do on campus. And so many, many times we're the only military face, the only Army face that many of our fellow citizens see on a daily basis. So that's probably one of the biggest parts of our job.
Let's talk about that a little more, because that's a great topic. People on college campuses, they see ROTC cadets, they're either gathering information or they're doing physical training or they're, doing whatever the cadets do on a campus, studying, things like that. And if somebody lives near a high school in Chicago or other metropolitan areas, they're going to see the cadets in uniform doing things. And I don't think that people truly know what's happening there on these kind of things. And I think maybe there are some misconceptions that we'll get into. And I don't also think that people understand the value of the programs to the institutions that they're in addition to the students. So, Andy, will you tell me a little bit about some of those values?
Sure. I'm probably going to take great risk here in replying to this question, because Dr. Coombe is an alumnus of the United States Military Academy. But I have to draw a comparison, and I think it'll help bring out the distinction. At the Military Academy, the military instruction that your development to become a professional Army officer is completely integrated into the entire program of study. It is inherently all part of the same cloth. In ROTC, we have a slightly different challenge. We have to stitch in the military instruction, the professional development, how we build leaders of character into 275 different programs of study across these campuses across the entire nation. Some fit relatively easily, particularly if you go to a senior military college like the Citadel or VMI or Norwich, for instance. But many of our civilian institutions, those programs of study vary widely. So how do we put our curriculum to match theirs and go through our program of study to develop leaders fit in? So that's the first challenge that we face, of how do we go about doing that. I would argue that an ROTC cadet has a really distinct challenge in that they have to get their degree, because you can't become a commissioned Army officer without having a bachelor's degree. So they have to accomplish their degree, and frequently we ask them to take STEM degrees. At least 25% of our cohort are STEM degrees. And then how do we fit in all the additional military instruction and leadership instruction that we expect into it? So we spend a lot of time on weekends and summers in order to get that done. So I would say that's our primary challenge, or one of the first challenges that we face in ROTC.
Yeah, I think in the junior ROTC program, and we talk about citizenship, I think what really defines it for us, what does citizenship mean? I mean, citizenship means a lot of things, but even within the high school community itself,
what we find the kids that tend to be in there are the kids that, when there's report card pickup, as an example, they're the kids that come in and they assist the principal in their uniform. They learn about pride and taking care of themselves. They learn what it's like to be in charge of teams, to accomplish tasks and be put in positions that others don't. We reward involvement in the school. So a lot of our JROTC cadets, the number one goal is to make them college ready or whatever their career is post high school. That's the number one goal. So involvement, we reward that. If you're on a sports team, you know, you get a ribbon for being a soccer player or a football player. We encourage them to be in programs like band, National Honor Society. Matter of fact, each school has a local school council. The school that I was at prior to taking this director's position for the last 3 years, the student representative on the local school council was a JROTC member. So learning what it's like to be involved in community, to include that service learning piece. And they actually get directly involved within the communities around those schools. So I think that citizenship piece, the leadership piece, the preparation for life after high school is what our primary focus is.
So if you were to, because Arthur, you basically already said this, but that this is in addition to it being training for officers and citizenship programs for students in high school, it's also a way that the armed services are reaching out into the civilian world with all sorts of different tools and things and vehicles for that outreach. But if you're, you know, if somebody's driving by or somebody's walking by, you know, a professor maybe who isn't, you know, has no idea what the ROTC is, or a mom dropping their kid off to high school for that kid's not in JROTC, what would you want them to essentially know?
Well, on the senior side, first, it's a professional program. We are building a professional Army officer. And so our program of instruction begins at the basic level. We actually call it the basic course for freshman and sophomore year. And in junior and senior year, it is the advanced course. Your first 2 years are really focused on character development. It's about how do we build your skills as a person. We're certainly testing to make sure that you're right for the Army and the Army is right for you, and that's a big part of it. A key feature of our basic course is that any student can take it. On any college campus, if it offers ROTC, you don't have to be interested or have a desire to go into military at all. But if you're interested, you can take it as a freshman and sophomore. Before moving out to the advanced course, though, you're going to have to make a commitment to the Army and say, yes, I do, in fact, want to be an Army officer. Then once we do get you into the advanced course, we start looking at what are those professional skills you need as an Army officer, and we start to put things more in a military context. So we value critical thinking. We value creative thinking. We value leadership above all else. And we value problem solving. And so we want to put all those things together in a military context. Can you lead America's young men and women that come to us, into our Army to help defend our nation? And we want to make sure that you have the right skills to do that. So you have to take at least one class every semester. It's called military science, though we do a lot more than just science type, obviously, topics. You have to do physical training frequently 3 or more days a week. We'll have to take a weekend here or there to do some field exercises or training, and then we'll ask you to go on various summer programs to augment your on-campus training, because there's many things we just can't do on a campus, like land navigation, hard to do in the city of Chicago. So we'll have to take you to where maybe there's some woods and some contour lines in order to do that. So those are very practical, technical skills that we can't get at. But it's much more than that. It's really all about leadership and critical thinking and imbuing you with the right traits and qualities to lead young men and women in very difficult circumstances. And that's what senior ROTC and being an Army officer is all about.
Well, it's fascinating. Any college student can take courses.
Yes.
Without
absolutely.
Any commitment.
And that's part of the agreement between the Department of Defense and college campuses is that we frequently what they find is our curriculum is put together by people a heck of a lot smarter than me that are college-level courses. And so we want anyone who comes in contact with Army ROTC to learn about their nation's Army and certainly then to take some skills with them. I mean, we want leaders of character throughout our entire society, not just within our Army. And we hope that in those first 2 years of ROTC, they get a sense of that. They come to understand what their Army is. They understand that it is, in fact, America's Army, and they are part owners of that. And then they go back out into whatever their civilian career is and are able to share that with others. So that is a big part of what we do.
Well, Arthur, what are the things that you have encountered in your research that really point to this being a key component of the program?
Well, since 1973, as we're all aware, the number of people with direct military experience has been shrinking. fewer and fewer people have any connection personally with the military establishment. Through JROTC and through senior ROTC, not only the cadets, and there are about, you know, almost 600,000 of them now if you include all the armed forces, but their parents, their friends, their associates, is putting a personal face on the military establishment. Not necessarily instilling views in people or in cadets or in their parents, but kind of giving them a personal feeling of who is in the military, what these people are doing, what these people need. So that's what I see. This personal connection is absolutely essential in an era where fewer and fewer people are connecting with the military.
Dan, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest challenge, maybe misperception is a better word. I think there is confusion a lot, and even sometimes amongst the faculty within the Chicago Public Schools is there's the impression they think that we are recruiters. So there's a lot of the similar educational things, the STEM focus that Colonel Morgado talked about, which we kind of echo within the classrooms within the JROTC program as well. But the difference is, unlike the senior program, which is a commissioning source, we are not. I'm not a recruiter. I don't get paid anything extra to recruit people in the military. It's very important that people understand that. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we want kids to be college ready. We want them to pursue careers they want. Now, if a cadet wants to have a career in the military, we're certainly going to help him to achieve that. We work things out with the senior program. In fact, when Colonel Morgado was talking about the basically in layman's terms, is trying out the program without a commitment. There are scholarships, tuition waivers that you can get to go in ROTC programs sponsored right here in Chicago, and we give kids opportunities to try out for those. But once again, we're not a recruiter. I think the value that the kids have is just—it's just undeniable. I think there tends to be, and I don't have the exact statistics, but there tends to be a higher grade point average of the kids who are in ROTC or JROTC. There tends to be a higher graduation level for the kids who are in JROTC. So we see the real, true results that happen from being a part of this program and being a part of an organization that's bigger than yourselves. Yeah, they're proud of the uniform, and they do understand that they represent something that, is tied to the military, but not tied to the military. You know, it's almost kind of a contradiction in terms, but, you know, they feel very much a part of it, but really they're not in terms of any sort of obligation or anything like that, and we certainly don't push them that way.
Again, Dan brings up a great point about, you know, the recruiting aspect of it. Certainly in senior ROTC, we do not look at junior ROTC as a means to recruit. Our bottom line is we are not a hard sell organization. Not to denigrate our recruiting command brothers and sisters who have to go out and find and recruit soldiers for our Army. And ROTC, it has to be a calling or a vocation. You've really got to want to be an Army officer and understand that the pain, not to understate it, suffering and commitment and sacrifice that you're going to have to make to be an Army officer. And we're not going to hard sell that. We're not going to twist your arm to come join. We hope to offer and show you what we have to offer. And you should be compelled to do that because there's a seed of leadership or national service or selfless service inside of you that wants to make you commit. And certainly we don't go to junior ROTC looking for recruits. Those two programs are very distinct in that way.
Well, Arthur, let's talk a little bit about the history of the criticism of the program, and then Dan and Andy, I'll want to have you talk about some of your experiences in dealing with some of the critics, because I know that you all have personal experience. But let's talk about some of the history of where the criticism comes from historically and kind of where it's gone.
Well, I might comment at this point that even before JROTC is established, even in some of its predecessor organizations, the church-related Boys Brigade, for example, or the Grand Army of the Republic's American Guard units, there were charges that these organizations, these military high school organizations, were nothing but fronts for military recruiting. And of course, when JROTC was created in 1916, there were, especially among pacifist organizations, heavy criticism that this entire JROTC was nothing but a front for recruiting. And so that charge has been around a long time, and it was predicated on some mistaken beliefs. The people really didn't delve into what the government was doing. If they would have read, for example, some of the official records at the time of the chief of staff, General Leonard Wood, very famous general in the first two decades of the 20th century. For him, JROTC and the senior ROTC exemplified the citizen-soldier concept. To Wood, it was a guard against militarism. It was a guard against the creation of a military caste. So when he tried to promote JROTC and senior ROTC, it was definitely with a view towards warding off any sort of militaristic tendencies in the U.S. Army and the military establishment. So
that's a bit of an irony, don't you think? But it makes total sense when you look at who we fought during the Second World War. We fought highly militarized societies in Germany and Japan, where the ethos of the military was everywhere and obligatory to everybody.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. And that's exactly what we tried to avoid with the creation of senior ROTC. There was something thought to be unique about blending military training with high school and college studies. It's not like you're studying in a caserne in a military base. You get a more liberal, you get a more broad-based education doing it the ROTC way. Even though Leonard Wood admitted that possibly we might be sacrificing a little efficiency, he thought that the political goals, and I put that in parentheses, was more important than military efficiency, making sure we had an army that was dedicated to Republican and Democratic principles.
Just a note, Dr. Trump, of how that's been translated into modern time is that about 65%, I would say about 60% of our graduates go on active duty, and this is out of 6,000 lieutenants that we commission every year. 40% go into the reserve component. We are the only federal source of commissions within the U.S. Army Reserve and the National Guard. So a large chunk of the lieutenants that we produce go into the reserve component. So it's that connection back to that non-militarization and that idea.
Well, I think that the idea of not being militarized but having an active citizen-soldier-based group of armed services is really important and something that's uniquely American. Mm-hmm. And how would you talk to the critics of JROTC and ROTC in those lines?
My response would be that you're aiming at the wrong organizations. If you want to attack militarism, the last place you should be looking is senior ROTC and junior ROTC. The other commissioning sources certainly aren't militaristic organizations, but they certainly fit the bill better than junior ROTC and senior ROTC do.
Andy, what are some experiences you've had, and Dan, I'll ask you the same question, in dealing with critics of these programs?
Well, probably not as specific or pointed perhaps as junior ROTC, but in senior ROTC, many of our campus leaders question, particularly in our religious colleges and universities, if military service is compatible to what they're trying to accomplish on their campuses. But generally speaking, the way around that argument or the way I address that argument is, well, if we're going to have an army in our nation and if we're going to produce officers from this institution, wouldn't you prefer to have that army officer be imbued with your institution's high standards and character, which I argue things that the Army is doing as well? Wouldn't you want that officer to lead in the Army, someone that you've put your stamp on in your unique way from your institution? So that's really the greatest bulk of criticism that we get, but it's fairly minor, and I think people understand the logic of that argument.
Dan, you've got a slightly different story.
Yeah, well, in Chicago, we've got, if you take, I guess the best illustration, if you took a map of Chicago and you took a handful of paint and you splattered it on there, our 45 schools really kind of represent the neighborhoods of Chicago. They're distributed pretty relative to the population. So the population of our program represents the demographics of the city of Chicago pretty well. So you get kids from all walks of life. But, we do have a lot of our schools, and they just, because, it's by the very definition of Chicago, it's an urban environment. So we have a lot of, minority kids and you know, typically African-American and Hispanic kids, a good majority. But then, you know, it's a mix, once again, kind of matches the cross-section. So there have been organizations that have, you know, kind of accused us of perhaps, you know, pandering to some of the minorities that are disadvantaged in order to recruit them in the military. And, you know, we've had to address those claims. We've basically, you know, rest our, you know, our laurels on the fact, once again, that, you know, we're not recruiters. It's a citizenship program. There's been accusations that you know, we teach kids to be mindless robots, you know, that but the truth of it is it's not that way at all. You know, we have debate, we have critical thinking. Our curriculum is aligned with the Common Core that, you know, looks at all the different aspects that you have. And we embody everything. Just like the senior program, physical fitness is important too, because you get a physical education credit for being JROTC. So it's not only actively being involved in service learning, we work on trying to be physically fit, mentally sharp, it's the whole picture. But there's absolutely no tie with, you know, having to go into the military. So, you know, our critics out there have basically accused us, you know, of you know, trying to brainwash, to use the word, these kids into becoming, you know, mindless military machines, and it's really not that case at all.
To answer them, do parents get involved with these discussions?
Well, the ironic thing is, as a lot of the kids that come in the program, and it's kind of funny because we're supposed to be, it's an all-volunteer program, but a lot of the kids are in there because their parents volunteer them to be in the program. Because the parents are some of our biggest supporters. You know, we'll get calls. There'll be calls from school counselors. The principals will get calls because the scheduler won't put them in ROTC. I want my son, I want my daughter in JROTC. You know, we get that all the time. So, and frankly, because it's a volunteer program, if a parent has a concern, thinks that we're recruited, well, then they don't have to be in JROTC. I mean, so there's no conflict that way when it comes to the parents. Once again, big supporters. You know, it's really people who may have had military experience in the past, you know, whether it be serving active duty, maybe JROTC itself. And that's one thing I got to tell you, I am a product of JROTC. I grew up in Rockford, Illinois, about an hour northwest of here. And I was a freshman in 1973, the very same year that women were allowed into JROTC as well. So I saw how that's changed in a way, kind of a microcosm in a sense of, you know, the rest of society. But, you know, in those days, the tie, perhaps, to the military was a little bit more direct. So maybe some of the experience, especially some of our people who grew up in the Vietnam War era, were used to that more direct tie. But it's not that way anymore. And we intentionally separate that tie, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. Well, let's go into the classroom a little bit. Let's talk about who's doing the teaching in the ROTC environment and the university campuses.
Well, at the university, it's really a team of teams. The primary core will be an active duty lieutenant colonel, will be what's called a professor of military science at each one of these campuses. And generally speaking, they'll have 3 to 4 additional active duty members of the Army on board, depending upon the size of the program. There'll be a senior non-commissioned officer. There'll be probably 2 or 3 additional officers that are on staff. Then we get a considerable amount of support from local National Guard units, state National Guards, who have a vested interest since we're producing a good part of their population. So they'll provide officers to teach in our classrooms. All of them have at least a bachelor's degree. Our professor of military science must have a master's degree as part of their education. Then we have a core of Army civilians. So these are our civil servants that operate different functions at these programs. We do contract a small portion of it. These are, if we have swings in our active duty strength, every now and then we have to fill in with a contracted position, but normally these are civilians who contract and have military experience. So that forms the core of who's teaching on our campuses. And all of them, by the way, have to be certified by the university. And we also have our own internal cadet command cadre certification program that ensures that we're putting the highest quality instructors and educators in our classrooms.
So it's all organized out of the military. These are people on deployment, basically. This is your assignment. This is what you do, and you're told to go, and when you go?
Yeah, absolutely. And 2 to 3 year assignments, which in the world of academia is just but a blink of an eye. And I frequently have college presidents complaining of, why are you taking my PMS away from me? Well, because the PMS has to go back into the active army and continue serving. So as for our civilian corps actually come in, so the Department of Army civilians are professionals as well, so they help provide a lot of that continuity. But yeah, they're serving an active duty assignment, and they'll go back into the active army usually and continue to serve somewhere else.
So that constant rotation is also a teaching tool for the college to say, hey, this is just how the Army is.
Yes.
This is what goes on. We all go through this.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So who's teaching in a JROTC?
Well, that's interesting because the optics are very similar. So you see a guy like me, and of course, I'll shave my temples close to kind of hide the gray hair and things like that. But we're retired officers and non-commissioned officers that have done a minimum of 20 years in the military. Our NCOs have to have a requirement of having an associate's degree. Most of them are encouraged, and while they're here, they'll get their bachelor's and many times master's, and we have several who are working on their doctorates. The officers have to have a minimum of a bachelor's degree, but we are retired military. We're hired because we're military professionals, but we're also educators. So once again, he has the challenge of people complaining. Maybe the complaints here is that maybe these guys should go away after a while because they can be here for quite a while. So basically, this is a retirement opportunity for us. And so we're actually hired in the case of Chicago, the Chicago Board of Education. So we're actually a City of Chicago employee, but we wear the uniform. We represent our service, so we need to maintain the professional standards, but a little bit different in terms of how we're manned.
And just for our audience, retirement doesn't necessarily mean somebody who's 60. It means somebody who's 40,
right,
or 45.
In fact, it's really interesting because this is one of the pep talks I give when I talk to my own instructors, because we have our own professional development. So we want to maintain currency. We're required. We keep what we call our portfolio, a professional portfolio, about how we're advancing our careers and how we're doing better within that. But there's a slide that I always like to quote. It was part of our initial training, but it says you're actively retired, or you're retired from active duty, but you're actively retired. And it says it's a quote from the training that his guys send us. It says expect 60-hour work weeks and some weekends. So our best instructors are out there working with the kids, staying after school, coming early, helping kids with their homework. I mean, there's a lot of the things that we do that we're expected to do, and because we have that mindset of having been military professionals. It's not a 9-to-5 job. It's you do the job until you get it done, and the most impact that you can have on those kids. And I will tell you this, the most rewarding thing that I've experienced prior to coming to this position, in order to get blued, so to speak, I spent 3+ years down at one of the schools. It's so rewarding when you see those young girls and boys, and you see how they grow from their freshman year to their senior year, and they grow as people, and you really have an impact. And especially some of the rougher neighborhoods, a lot of times both our male and female instructors become role models to those kids that sometimes is lacking in their home environment. So it's very rewarding, and the vast majority of our instructors have such a great passion to do that. So that's the thing that I take away, and that's the thing that really keeps me going and wants me to stay here and do this.
Well, Dan, let me follow up with that. What is a student going to experience in the classroom? What kind of teaching?
Well, we actually have an approved curriculum, and we can modify that. But we do look at the government. You know, it's almost like when you take government econ. We look at the branches of government. We do have classes, especially for the basic cadets. You do learn your basic discipline, how to wear a uniform, how to march, and all that sort of thing. Because those are things you have to have as a cornerstone if you're going to be in an organization that's structured on the military, but we have health classes in there. We learn first aid. I mentioned the branches of government. We learn about what does leadership mean. We have a program called Winning Colors, which is a leadership. It talks about, are you a leader, a builder? Are you a relator, which is a person who's more into the kind of sensitive side? Are you a planner? Are you an adventurer? We look at the qualities of an individual and how that affects leadership and how you act in a group dynamic. It's in a lot of ways. There's a lot of social studies that's in there. It's a lot of physical education that's in there. It's a lot of health that's in there,
It's a curriculum that really fits well with the rest of the school. And I've had teachers that are supporters come to see us, and they really envy a lot of ways the curriculum and the depth that we get into in a lot of our subjects. So it's very broad, and in some areas very deep, depending on what the topic is.
Yeah, I think Dan nailed it. I'll only add, I've certainly not have sat through or administered as many classes as Dan has with Junior ROTC, but I would term it civics plus plus. I mean, and the beauty of it is that there's a huge practicum period, so cadets are physically hands-on doing things as opposed to just sitting passively in a classroom. But the curriculum is top-notch. It's civics plus plus, I would say.
I would like to add that this commitment to active learning is something that's been with the program since its very early days. I've looked at some reports from inspectors that went around and inspected senior and junior ROTC detachments in the 1920s. And the inspection list included references to John Dewey's active learning. Were the cadets involved in the instruction? Were they actually doing things in the classroom, or was it a dead lecture? And of course, those units that did the active learning got high marks, and those units that did the old lecture got low marks. So that's something that I think that the ROTC has been at least emphasizing since its inception.
I want to piggyback on that, and you, I'm glad you said that, because what we do is the instructors facilitate, but we teach the cadets to lead. And that's kind of when I talk about the beauty piece of seeing a kid that comes in as a freshman and leaves as a senior. You see those kids become leaders in their own right, whether it's leading a drill team or so. You teach the freshmen how to do the basic things, and then they become the teachers later on as upperclassmen. And it's the amount of confidence they have. Part of our accreditation program, we do command briefings. You have cadets briefing school administrators, briefing people from Colonel Morgado's headquarters or higher, people, outsiders coming. You have young cadets talking about the virtues of their program and the service learning that they do and the great things that they do. The confidence that those kids have. I will tell you, they do some presentations. I was at one the other day. I'll give credit where credit's due. I was at Farragut High School, Patton Academy. The level of presentation that those kids put together was better than anything I've seen in college, and frankly, some of our professional corporations would have really been envious of the kind of work those kids put into it. So,
before we get into the ROTC classroom setting, I want to ask you a question in particular. Any good learning institution from a college or a high school is going to basically say, okay, here are all the sources on a topic. You're going to find opposing ideas. You're going to find, enemy sides in a conflict. You're going to find various political views. You're going to find books by, leaders that have been demonized. You're going to find books by leaders who have been lofted up as some kind of hero that they maybe weren't. You're going to get that very interesting cross-section of education and academic engagement. And so this active teaching that you're talking about, how is that happening on the college level and on the JROTC level to actually challenge these kids to think for themselves? Because that's, I think, personally, a core of any academic institution. How are you doing it?
We place a large premium on critical thinking and to challenge everything that's being presented in the classroom. So cadets are required to write frequently. They're required to, on a different level and scale, to get up before their peers and superiors and state a position and state an argument. That's all part of the curriculum. We use Bloom's taxonomy as terms of our kind of a rubric for how we develop cadets and level of understanding and education that we want to get them to. But that dialectic is very much part of our instructional method. And then in senior ROTC, we have the practicum. So do we approach and do we introduce military tactics? We do, but we're not there to make tacticians. We are providing that military context to assess their leadership ability. And the greatest learner and the greatest teacher, and the cadets in the studio audience will appreciate it, is failure, right? So we want to put cadets in a situation where they're going to fail miserably, and not to shame them, not to denigrate them, but then we pick them up, we brush them off, and then, hey, all right, cadet, now let's talk about what happened. And so what went wrong, and how are we going to do this better the next time? And then we put them back on the pony and let them ride again. And I bet you on that second iteration, they're going to do a lot better because they've learned from real and practical experience. So that has been, I think, the ROTC model for quite some time, and we continue to improve upon it and really focus on the intellectual capacity and the abilities of our leaders. So that's been our approach.
I would just like to piggyback as far back as just the back what he just said. Back as in the 50s and 40s, you actually had debates being conducted in senior ROTC and junior ROTC. The instructor would pick a controversial issue, break the cadets into sides, and have them debate each other, having them completely understand both sides of the issue at hand and try to get one to out-debate the other. So I think this has been endemic in ROTC for some time.
Yeah, I was exactly going to say that. We'll pick a controversial topic, current events, and we'll let the kids debate out. Sometimes we'll do it as an event in class where we'll break them in a couple different groups and give them some time to put their presentations to give opposing views, sort of like a mini debate. We do that. They also talk about open-minded critical thinking. We'll have different times. We also have writing requirements. You know, we'll do essays. And each school will do things different, but every year there's a JROTC essay contest, and there'll be a theme that's picked from higher headquarters. And we'll have everybody do that to see what the best topic is. But also monthly topics, if it's African American History Month or if it's Hispanic History Month, we'll give writing topics, and we'll let cadets, pick people that they want to write about. It might be a controversial person, and we'll let them present that, and we'll let the kids ask questions. So we're always about critical thinking. We're always about hearing different opinions. So we do that within our classroom.
Right, and I would say one of the things that we teach is particularly in senior ROTC, is the Army, as we all know, is a very hierarchical organization, right? There's colonels and there's privates. But the key message to our leaders is that if you rely on the rank that's on your collar in order to get the job done, you will not succeed as a leader. So how are you going to be influential and lead peers and get folks to do a very difficult job? And so that is a people business and requires a lot of nuance and a light touch at times. So that we are constantly emphasizing that and having cadets practice that skill to lead people, provide purpose, direction, and motivation to accomplish tough missions. And you're not going to do that in strictly a lecture sense. They have to go out there, feel it, experience it, and try things out.
I think it's important to point out that the JROTC student is a minor that is under the command of their parents, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And so you get into ROTC, and these are adults who have made decisions on their own.
Yeah.
So the parents are a big part of the JROTC experience. Arthur, let's talk a little bit about the history. We've kind of touched on it a little bit. But there is a long history before the Defense Act of 1916. And if you'd explain that to the audience, that would be great.
Well, it literally goes back until colonial days, the idea of school-age children taking military training. But in the modern version, perhaps we can go back just to the Civil War. Places like Bangor, Maine, and the Boston school system started to create age-graded military units during the Civil War. Now, this had a very practical use. You know, they wanted their kids to get some training before, if they ever got called out to go fight in the Civil War, they'd have it. The basic drill, maybe a little bit of marksmanship. However, soon after that, the biggest citizenship-oriented training that occurred with something called the Boys Brigades. And actually, it started in Scotland as a program of the Presbyterian Church. And they wanted to teach character development to the kids that went to their Sunday schools. So they made up this Boys Brigade organization, and it was quite popular in Scotland. In the early 80s, it was transferred to San Francisco, where the churches there in San Francisco got a hold of it and tried to adapt to their needs in San Francisco. It caught on like wildfire. It jumped out to Chicago, and from Chicago to cities all across the East. And basically, it was a program devoted to, I guess you could call it citizenship, or probably more accurately, character development. instilling self-discipline in young people, instilling the idea that there was an authority to society, loyalty to your organization, that those certain character traits that people thought were important for someone to succeed in the adult world. And so they got very big. There was an organization that amounted to probably 100,000, and that didn't count certain offshoots. The Catholic Church wasn't a part of the Boys' Brigades, but they developed their own units. The Methodist Church developed their own units. So it was quite a going enterprise. In the 1890s, that was eclipsed by another widespread movement called the American Guard military units, and they were high school based, age graded type of units that were especially powerful in the large cities of the United States. And the American Guard was closely associated with the Grand Army of the Republic, the Civil War veterans organizations, and again, it was an organization really focused on character development and patriotism. The 90s, the early 90s especially, were a period of intense nationalism, and the American Guard picked that up. They taught flag etiquette, they taught loyalty to the country, they taught certain work-related skills like self-discipline, punctuality, that sort of thing that would help these kids when they got a job in industry, quite frankly. So the American Guard units ran very strongly until the Spanish-American War, and after that they kind of declined. They didn't go away, but they certainly declined from where they were. So those two things were huge. And one American Guard unit parade in New York City in the 1890s, there were 40,000 American Guard cadets that actually took place in this thing. So there was a very strong military unit tradition in high school even before the JROTC was created in 1916.
So as JROTC and ROTC have progressed from 1916 to now, will you kind of give us a walkthrough of how that's changed? For example, there were more direct ties built into the system back in the day that we've abandoned probably around the Vietnam War.
Yes, that's true. Originally, of course, you could get a commission through senior ROTC. All of the units from 1916 until really the early 50s were branch specific. In other words, you didn't go to get a commission. You went to senior ROTC to get a commission in the infantry or the engineers. Very, very specific, and the instruction on campus was focused on very specific technical skills. So that was one difference. In JROTC, it's always been a very wide-ranging program. Now, certainly in the early days, there was a military component to it. There were a number of people that got commissions through JROTC. It wasn't large. It was something like 300 or 400 people from 1916 to 1941 were commissioned through JROTC. And they actually had to graduate from high school, then wait a couple of years until they got their baccalaureate degree before finally getting commissioned. But they were commissioned through JROTC. So that was one aspect of it. But that, again, disappeared right after World War II. After World War II, you couldn't get it. But from the very first, it did have this citizenship goal. We've talked about Leonard Wood, what he expected of it. They saw citizenship a big, big priority. And this had to do with, number one, there was a problem with discipline in the new schools that were arising in the country. Remember, this was a period of rapid urbanization and rapid industrialization. So it presented the country with challenges it didn't have before. You had a lot of people living in the cities that weren't used to living in the cities. In citizenship training, teaching them what it meant to be an American, and that was, of course, education about the Constitution, how to live as a good citizen and your responsibilities as a citizen. It also had to do with the waves of immigration that were occurring in the early 20th centuries. You had a lot of people from overseas coming that weren't familiar with America or its traditions, its Republican and Democratic principles. And one of the missions of Junior ROTC was to teach immigrants what it meant to be an American. And that was a big issue with them. The other thing, as I mentioned, it was a period of rapid industrialization, so workforce preparation was a big mission of JROTC. Teaching things like punctuality, teaching things like self-discipline, what it means to be a loyal worker, all those things were inculcated in students through the Junior ROTC, in addition to the military mission. The head civilian that was in charge of the JROTC curriculum got a letter from a concerned principal, and the principal asked, what is this thing, Junior ROTC? What is it for? Is it a military program? Is it a citizenship program? Is it a workforce presentation program? What exactly is it? Because it encompassed a lot of disparate type of things that the government wanted done. And of course, as you alluded to, one of the biggest changes came in during the Vietnam War, the history. It changed both Junior ROTC and Senior ROTC forever. Now, the change for Senior ROTC really began before the Vietnam War, because it initially reacted to John Kennedy and Robert McNamara's flexible response strategy. They went from an army of 800,000 to an active army of 1 million, and they wanted to build up the Senior ROTC, and they were having trouble recruiting. So some of the things they did to change the nature of the JROTC is, number one, they introduced a scholarship program. Prior to this, there were no scholarships. 1964, with the passage of the ROTC Vitalization Act, was the first time that the ROTC did a scholarship. The Navy had it before, but not the Army. Secondly, they started a two-year program. You could get now a commission through ROTC in 2 years. Now, this was originally targeted at community and junior college people, but soon after the act was passed, they extended it to everybody that went to college could go through this two-year program. They introduced an enhanced stipend at the time to draw more people in. They also added greatly to the Senior ROTC institutional base. In fact, the number of units was increased or expanded by 20%. They needed more people, so they needed more units. And the nature of the ROTC institutional base changed. More units were incorporated from the West and especially the South, and fewer units were maintained in the East. Now, that was self-selection in a lot of cases. Harvard, Yale, Dartmouth obviously dropped it because of the turmoil coming out of the war. But their places were taken up by schools in the West and the South. And part of this had to do with Lyndon Johnson, his desire to spread federal wealth more evenly. You know, schools in the East tended to be getting all the federal dollars, and schools in the South and the West, very few. And so he tried to pour more funds to those schools in the South. He also was in the Army. He wanted to go where they were wanted. And in the East, they weren't always wanted. In the South and the West, in the Midwest, they were wanted. So that played a part into it, ROTC expanding where it was wanted. And finally, the population base of the country was moving from the Northeast to the South and to the West. And in many ways, all that did, this changing composition, was follow the population trends. It was too heavily unbalanced in the East, as it was before the Vietnam War. By the end of the Vietnam War, they were represented approximately according to their geographic representation. So that was a big change for ROTC. So that was two big things. The other thing that happened during the Vietnam War that set off changes was a push to get more a diverse student body in ROTC, especially Hispanics, and especially at that time, African Americans. It started off slow from 65 and 70. The Army made slow progress incorporating African Americans into its production base. But by the end of the 70s, 10% of ROTC production was minority. No, specifically African American. About 20% overall was minority. So great strides were made during Vietnam in the immediate in the period immediately thereafter. So that changed it. The other thing that occurred in the very end of the Vietnam War was the admission of women into the senior ROTC. That occurred on an experimental basis in 1972, and it was thrown out open to all women in 1973. So that was a big thing for the ROTC. Having women and minorities now is vital parts of the senior ROTC system. Without women and minorities, probably it would have been very difficult for the United States to make a go of ROTC in the all-volunteer force. So they were one historian called them the margin of success for the ROTC in the era of the early 70s. A similar transformation took place with the junior ROTC. That was almost a specifically white program before 1964. After 1964, it became much more diverse. In fact, by 1972, 42% of the JROTC students' enrollment were African Americans, fully 42% by 1972. As Dan was saying, they started incorporating women into the JROTC counting in the early 70s. That also had a tremendous effect. So if you look at the number of cadets in the program, white cadets in the program, actually there were a lot fewer white cadets in the program in 1975 than there were in 1964. But because it became such a more diverse program, the enrollment overall shot up markedly. Finally, it expanded from 295 units of JROTC units in 1964. It expanded in the Army alone to 685 by 1973. JROTC was also thrown open to the other services, so the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marines became sponsors of JROTC in 1964. And so, all told, by 1973, there were about 1,200 JROTC units. And that was a major transformation of junior ROTC. And finally, he talked about the differences in cadre. Well, the junior program used to have active duty cadre, fully supported by active duty cadre. That started to change in 1964. And by 1973, with the few exceptions of a military school here or there, the entire junior ROTC instructor force was retired instructors. And of course, that made it much more palatable to the Defense Department because the costs were much less. Now, I might add, during the Vitalization Act of 1964, Robert McNamara, our Secretary of Defense, decided that he would eliminate JROTC, and he was about ready to go through with this elimination. He met, because his justification was it adds nothing to readiness. Junior ROTC is not a recruiting tool. It does not provide soldiers for our Army, so what are we doing hosting a citizenship program? He was quite blunt about it, and his idea was let's get rid of it if it's not contributing to national defense. And of course, people, especially Congressman Edward E. Baer from Louisiana being the most notable, but there were hundreds, said that you don't understand national defense, Mr. Secretary, I'm sorry. You have to reconsider what you're doing. And so basically the Congress stepped in and said, not only are you not going to eliminate it, but you're going to expand it to 1,200 units. So McNamara kind of had to back off and say, okay, I see the error of my ways. We're going to expand it. I mean, he had no choice, but he did manage to at least save a little money with the retired instructors. So that was the nearest. I mean, attempts have been made since then to do away with the junior ROTC by the military. And by the way, The Army, the Navy, and the Air Force stood with McNamara on this. This wasn't only McNamara. The services were with him. But again, there was such a political outcry. One of the noisiest, by the way, was a certain Mayor Daley of Chicago that led the cry against abolishing junior ROTC. So that was an interesting tidbit. And it's never been threatened in quite the same way again, although there are critics coming out of from time to time that would like to see it eliminated.
Just to give a size comparison of where the program is now, we're for senior ROTC, we're on just under 1,000 campuses nationwide, and in junior ROTC, we are in just over 1,700 high schools across the country.
One question that I have for you guys is that to be a ROTC cadet or to be a JROTC cadet sometimes means to put yourself in the crosshairs of being made fun of. You're in the crux of something that can be political because there are opposing sides on whether this is good or bad for our society and for our kids and things like that. So given the fact that it's something that can be challenging for the students to engage with something like this, why do they choose to do it? Because there's got to be a personal choice there. A little maybe less so when the parents are voluntolding them. Yeah. But they still have to go through with it.
But, you know, there's a lot of those kids, and I'll jump first real quick, but a lot of the kids that really love it and thrive for it, I mean, there are those challenges. I experienced it personally in 1973 coming in there because, you know, the doctor was talking about, you know, in the Midwest, you know, for the most part, it was probably much more accepted to be in it than it would be in other areas of the country. But a lot of times it depended on the demographics where you live. So I actually lived in a little town suburb called Cherry Valley, and we were considered Hicks. And we got bused to kind of a rich school, which was Guilford High School, where I went. And a lot of the kids were kind of, you know, looked down on us because we were wearing the uniform. But it was interesting because in some of the more urban areas, some of the more poor areas, it wasn't that sense at all. So it really depends on where you're at. My experience in Chicago with as far as the neighborhoods are, some of the schools, maybe, you know, especially that are gang infested or something like that, you know, kids will be taunted or teased because they think it's not cool. But the converse of that, which is the value of it, especially in those areas where those gangs are, this is an alternative to the gangs. This is an opportunity for those kids to get away from that environment. So instead of, you know, being up to no good on a weekend, we'll take a bus of 40, 50 kids out to a forest preserve and do some land navigation, some orienteering. You know, and instead of being up to no good, we'll take some kids for an archery meet. So we do a lot of productive kids to keep them out of those environments. So there is some negative peer pressure, but I think the desire and the kids that get a taste of what JROTC is about, the vast majority of them love it. And some of the reasons that some do drop out is just because of maybe academic conflictions with some of their higher level classes. And oh, by the way, to take some credit, I think a lot of times I've heard instructors complain to me that some of your smartest kids that kind of get trained up and become great leaders through JROTC are those same ones that have conflicts from their seniors because they have to take these additional AP classes because of the good that the program does. So I find more complaints about kids that are challenged to stay in the program than those that want to leave.
On the senior side, we offer 3,000 new full tuition scholarships every year as an incentive to bring young men and women to ROTC, spend $300 million a year on scholarship funds alone. But if you're only in it for the money, you're not going to stay. Or if you came for the money, you're not going to stay. It takes something more. Certainly not to be dramatic or overly sentimental, but there's a love of country there. And that's why cadets come and join our ranks. So they love their country. They want to serve. They want to be selfless. They want to be part of something bigger than themselves. And in terms of wearing the uniform, I always state it very simply to the cadets. This uniform that I wear is not mine. This is the nation's cloth. So your country has asked you to don this uniform and to serve and to protect it. And that, by far, is what keeps cadets in. And we commission 6,000 brand new lieutenants every year that are a testament to people who love their country and want to serve their country.
All right. I have one last question for you. We are a museum and library. So I'm kind of wondering, we'll start with Dan and work down the table. Do you have a book that you can suggest that we read that has helped you in your career? Or?
Sure. In fact, it's funny because I'm actually rereading it.
I've got an interest in the Korean War because my father's a Korean War vet, two uncles that were, and I see a lot of cadets are out here too. When I was got my commission, I was really, really told by my commander to actually read This Kind of War by Fehrenbach, because it really talks about a country who went from World War II very prepared, of a highly mobilized force, and how we went from 1945 to 1950 as being totally unprepared, not learning from our lessons. So that's a book I highly recommend. I highly recommend it to these senior ROTC cadets who are getting ready to graduate and become officers. But This Kind of War by Fehrenbach.
Great. Arthur?
I have two I'd like to mention. One is a book by Donald Downs, who's out of University of Wisconsin, and it's Arms in the University is the title, Arms in the University, and it deals with, among other things, the recent decision to bring ROTC back to Columbia. The next one I'd like to plug, my own book that's coming out, Steve Conley and Bill Skimmyhorn are my colleagues in OEMA, and we're coming out with a book called Still Scholars and Soldiers. It talks about West Point, ROTC, and OCS and their various screening methods from 1900 to the present day.
Great, and I would recommend, in addition to Dr. Coombs, two books on Cadet Command, which are very good. I would recommend Forging the Sword, and it was edited by Dr. Converse. So it's a collection of officer education essays and that looks at not only the Army, but joint services, but also international officer training programs. Super book.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for an excellent discussion. We could talk a lot more, but we're out of time. We need to turn it over to the audience so that they can ask you questions. So thank you very much. It was a great discussion. Thank you.
I'd like to ask both the senior and junior ROTC if you could give me some statistics on how many graduate and how many enrolled for both of you, and what is the G-point average for both senior and junior? And may I add one more book? Charlie... Mike, the mission continues.
Great. On the senior side, if I get all those components, I guess I don't know offhand what our retention rate. Certainly, it depends a lot upon the school. I would say from a beginning class, beginning to end, anywhere from 60 or above percent. But that's arcing a four-year experience. Historically, our GPAs are higher than the average at that university or college. They tend to be higher, and I know I'll let you speak for junior.
Yeah, and that's I don't have the exact, but they tend to be higher. In fact, at our military academies, give an example, Phoenix Military Academy is the number 8 school in the state of Illinois. They have a very, very high grade point average compared to the average. Their ACT average is higher than the average. As far as the percentage, you're talking about going to the military, really, it's negligible. I think you'll hear different statistics, different places, but the general population versus the kids in junior ROTC, not really a big difference. And once again, it's not our push to get them to join the military. If they do, I'm obviously a patriot guy. I served 30 years on active duty and did 3.5 years in the National Guard, part of that. So, I'm a fan, but that's not what our focus is.
And Dan, there was an exit survey done recently. I can't vouch for what year, but in a nationwide survey of junior ROTC cadets, 20% had interest in pursuing a career in the military following graduation. Whether they acted on that or joined the military, we don't know, but 20% showed an interest nationwide, and that's a total number of cadet population. I don't have the number in front of me, but we're hundreds of thousands of junior ROTC cadets.
What percentage of career military officers come from ROTC as opposed to the others? And my second question is, in 1972, we lost the military draft. How do you feel in terms of need and value of a national service program, including a military draft, but maybe not limited to a military draft?
Army ROTC makes up 70% of the Army's officer corps. So a large proportion of every, that includes active National Guard and Army Reserve. So 70% of the officer corps is ROTC. In terms of, we're doing great with volunteers. So I'm not sure if a draft is necessary or desired. Certainly, I guess I don't have an opinion on it, because what we have now seems to be working really well, and we're attracting some extremely high quality folks.
I'll piggyback on that, and I concur with what Andy says. I think, you'll hear people. One of the arguments when I was on active duty at the time, some of the proponents of the draft is that, well, sometimes that we tend to be insular and we're around military organizations or bases that tend to feed themselves, and perhaps you need a more cross-section of the public. Well, I see the point, but I tend to disagree in the sense with what Andy said, is that the people that we have in the Army, since we went to an all-volunteer Army, are people who, weren't told to go. They're there because they want to. Obviously, some may be, financial reasons, but a lot of it's patriotism, wanting to serve their country, want to do what Dad and Granddad did. But I think there's a lot to be said when people want to be there as opposed to being forced to be there. So I like it the way we've got it now.
We got a question from the internet. This is Daniel Smith, and he says, good afternoon. This is from Facebook, it looks like. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm currently enrolled in ROTC at the university I attend. For a long time, I've looked across at schools such as Virginia Tech and seen their Corps of Cadets program. I'd really like to see a Corps of Cadets at my college, but I don't know how the process would start or how that would work. Would it be possible to create a program like that at my college?
I think the answer would be yes, though there, I think there's several things that would have to get done. Just for understanding, there are 8 Army ROTC brigades across the country. Our first brigade is not geographically based like the remaining 7. Our first brigade is our senior military college brigade that has junior military colleges as well. So your Texas A&M's, your Virginia Tech's, as your person here is watching, observed. So they form a few number in schools compared to my brigade. We have 42 host programs. A small number of host programs, but produce thousands of lieutenants every year because of that military corps or structure that they have. In terms of beginning a corps, it really starts with that administration. We have had schools express interest in doing that. I had one example within the state of Missouri, the College of the Ozarks, commonly known as Hard Work U. The president has just reinstituted that every freshman will take military science upon coming in because patriotism is one of their core teaching principles. And so we are working with them to do that, and they're providing some additional resources to do that. So it would have to be a cooperative effort, I'm sure, or an interest by the administration to want to do something like that.
Excellent. All right, I got a challenge for one of the cadets. I know there's a question over there. You can't just sit there not ask a question. We got one right there. We've been talking about you the entire time, so.
So from the perspective of a cadet about to commission this coming May, how well do you feel your ROTC training prepared you for your entrance into the active Army?
You want to go first?
Sure. I attended Lehigh University, and I was very proud to have been part of the ROTC program there. I felt extremely well prepared. I thought, though it was kind of an interesting time to be in college or become an Army officer, the Soviet Union had gone away, and much of our training was really developed towards a very known and well-known enemy. But we were still taught the basics, which we still teach today, which was leadership, problem solving, and creative thinking. And I think it prepared me very, very well for that experience.
Yeah, for me too. I mean, I concur with that. I got commissioned in 82, initially in the National Guard, and finished up my college, and I went active duty in 83. But I was at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. One of the things that was really good about ROTC in college is it's a lot of it's time management. So, I went there, as you may have heard, I was a physical education guy. I played football. I played lacrosse. And I wasn't going to, and I knew guys that were in ROTC that talked about giving those things up, but I didn't want to give that. That's what I was about. So I did sports. I actually played the saxophone in the band, and I was doing ROTC. So that's time management. The time, I'll be honest with you, sometimes from a time management perspective, the schedule, what I was doing when I was in college ROTC was a lot of times more difficult than I did as an adult because there's maybe more focus as an adult. So I think it prepared me very well. And plus, it goes to the cadre, which we still have today. I had excellent cadre. Matter of fact, I'm an infantry guy. My class leader was a guy, I still remember him, Captain Rob Fercasa. He was my mentor, and he was an airborne ranger infantryman. I by golly, that's what I want to be. So, you know, so I mean, the effect that your instructors have on you to help mold you to become leaders is really great. So I love the program.
And just to add to that, again, I'm walking on thin ice again next to a military academy graduate, but I would say that your ROTC experience was particularly beneficial to me because just with that, I had to stitch my military program in together with my academic program, and the two did not always fit well together, and so there's a lot of give and take. Where at the military academy, I mean, it is part and parcel of one coherent whole, at least I assume that to be, not being a graduate there. So I found that to help me because I needed to be a heck of a lot smarter about how I fitted in the different components of my college experience. So it really helped me then to be an officer than having to manage complex systems, et cetera, because I kind of had some exposure to it.
Thank you. This may be a little bit off topic, but for those of us who are interested in doing research on relatives and ancestors that were involved in, say, JROTC, is there something like an archive, a centralized archive, where one could go and find records that they may have developed?
Not for JROTC.
Yeah. My experience is what little there is probably down in TRADOC, in the TRADOC historian's office, but it is very, very scant. So I would agree with your assessment. There is programmatic information in the National Archives, but in terms of individual people, it is hardly any, if any. I haven't uncovered anything. So with JROTC, if you're looking for individuals, I have not been able to come up with really anything very helpful.
Well, it goes to the core of the program. It's a private, voluntary activity, and they're not collecting that data. There's no big government thing collecting data on those people, historically.
Yeah, and I kind of want to piggyback on that because, you know, I'm not a historian and I don't play one on TV, but but when I was at Schurz High School, where I was before I got this current position, and Colonel Kelly's in the audience here, who was my former boss, and I found in our archives, I found some if they're in a file cabinet. There's these old yearbooks. And I was talking to a doctor about it before we came on that talked about the High School Volunteers of the United States, which was before ROTC, which came into Chicago in 1919. But I saw these, and it's like I was fascinated. But it's kind of sad that these documents haven't really been well preserved. And you know, I just make it as a comment. I love history, even though I'm not a historian, and sometimes it's kind of sad how we forget about a lot of the things that happened and what our ancestors did. But yeah, it's fascinating. There's stuff out there, but I just stumbled across it. So,
All right, one more question. I saw one in the back here.
Morning, gentlemen. My name is Cadet Craig from Columbia College, Chicago, and Chicago Army ROTC Fire Battalion. A point to Colonel Morgado, that was something you made a few moments ago. So how would you, and this could be for the entire panel, actually, do you compare ROTC officers as compared to officers from other commissioning sources like the Military Academy or OCS? Is there any intrinsic value? I mean, we certainly may be somewhat biased in this room. Is there any intrinsic value through the ROTC program, or would you even afford any in that respect?
Well, if I take lead, I think there's great value in diversity of outlook and origins. And so I think once you get commissioned and you join the operational army or in whatever component, you'll be mixed in with officer candidate school graduates, West Point graduates, and it doesn't take very long before you're working as one cohesive team because you're all wearing the same uniform, and it says, you know, on our fatigues, it says U.S. Armor over our left breast. It doesn't say your commissioning source. But there's value in that diversity that a West Pointer would bring from a different part of the country, from a distinct commissioning resource to, you know, the multiple schools that you could attend ROTC. And I think it adds to the conversation. And I think overall it helps makes us a stronger Army overall because of that diversity of thought and outlook.
I'm going to bring up something that's kind of sensitive, but I think with the West Point, the ROTC program, and in the ROTC program, people are screened from 2 to 4 years. Your PMS gets a pretty good look at you. It's hide to hard. It's very hard for a person to hide for 2 years, and even harder for him to hide for 4 years. West Point is the same way. So my natural prejudice and bias is for ROTC and West Point simply because you get a longer screening. OCS, they probably do better than ROTC and West Point in their initial assignments, but still, the screening process isn't there. But again, that's my personal take and bias.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for a wide range of discussion. Thank you to Colonel Andy Morgado, Dr. Arthur Kuhn, and Colonel Daniel Baggio for this outstanding discussion, and to the U.S. Army Public Affairs Midwest for supporting this program. To learn more about the museum and library, visit in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.